Mark chapter 8, verses 11 through 13. The Pharisees demand a sign. So right prior to this, we talked about feeding of the 4,000 and how it is similar to and different from feeding of the 5,000. Feeding of the 4,000 was a sign of the kingdom that includes all. And the bread, Jesus as the bread, there is abundance. There's no, the Jews get first dibs at the bread, and then whatever's left over is then available for the Gentiles. No, it's both Jews and Gentiles get their fill simultaneously, and even that there is leftovers available. And so Mark then places this three verses immediately after that feeding of the 4,000. So it reads, "The Pharisees came and began to argue with him," speaking of Jesus, "seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, 'Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation.' And he left them, got into the boat again, and went to the other side." So after the feeding of the 4,000, which was on the predominantly Gentile side of the sea, or Lake Gennesaret, Sea of Galilee, same thing, they went across to the region of Dalmanutha, which scholars have really no idea where it is, except for a speculation that it might be somewhere around Magdala, and that it would be on the Jewish side. So that's where the Pharisees come to question Jesus, to argue with him. So there's this entire section here from chapter 8, verses 1 through 21. Verse 21, I think, is a unit with this kind of in the middle, breaking apart two parts. A boat journey begins in verse 8 to 10, but these two, 11 through 13, kind of interrupt the progression. You might see this as yet another example of Mark's layering sandwich composition. The boat journey resumes in verse 14, where there's another story takes place on the seas. So in this chapter, we see kind of a zigzagging, crisscrossing of Jesus and his disciples in the boat between two opposing shores. Sometimes these three verses seem kind of almost random. Why did Mark place it here? Is it a random set of three verses, or did Mark intentionally put these three verses about the Pharisees demanding a sign here for a purpose? And as we've seen time and time again already, there is nothing random about Mark's composition, that he has a purpose.
And when it looks random and nonsensical, in our culture.
So this story is taking place on the Jewish side, and the Pharisees come and argue with Jesus, seeking from him a sign. Now, what does that mean? When they ask for a sign, what do you think they are asking?
Proof of heritage.
Okay. Well, what do you mean by heritage?
That he's actually the Son of God.
Okay.
That he has authority? Questioning questioning his authority to, I don't know, say what God's will is.
Okay. So, what do you think the Pharisees are expecting?
A miracle. Something miraculous and astonishing.
I don't know. They've already seen a lot of astonishing and miraculous mm-hmm. things. They're looking for proof. They want some lineage proof or something in a prophecy that is true that they have been waiting to come true. They want proof.
Are they really looking for proof, or are they looking for something to use against him? Are they wanting proof? Do they want to know that he is real? Or are they... I mean, over and over again, you see the Pharisees looking for something to use against him. Is that what they're doing here in some way?
Well, they're asking for a sign from heaven. Mm-hmm. That's the key phrase, sign from heaven.
A sign that he controls God? That something to show that he... that God does what he tells him?
Remember, the Pharisees, the scribes and the Pharisees are steeped in Old Testament scripture.
Uh-huh.
Sign from heaven has a very strong Old Testament connection.
Does it have to mirror signs that they've seen before? I mean, what is this? What is the specific sign they're looking for? I mean, what?
Where in the past have signs from heaven been given?
Well,
like
Moses,
the plagues?
Moses.
Hmm. Where else? The rainbow? Noah?
Possibly. There's another prophet that is very significant in the background of Mark's writing. Elijah.
Elijah. As in the chariot.
Well, he wrote the same about the woman that talked about the dogs. It was Elijah's writing, wasn't it? Or no?
No, that was...
No. No, okay, never mind.
No, Elijah. Remember, Elijah, he battled the prophets of Baal.
Right, and the...
He called down fire from
fire
heaven.
Fire from heaven. Okay.
So are the Pharisees looking for Jesus to smote their enemies and get rid of all people that aren't Jewish then? Is that what they're hoping to see?
Possibly.
So why is he hanging out with all these Gentiles? If he's...
Yeah.
So, the Pharisees are not looking for yet another miracle. They're looking for a sign. There's a difference between miracles and signs.
Really? Huh.
And I think in our modern reading of the Bible, we miss that.
Huh. Yes, definitely. A sign. Like... fire from heaven.
The concept of a sign is intelligible from the Old Testament and later Jewish literature. It signifies a token which guarantees the truthfulness of an utterance or the legitimacy of an action.
Or like the fleece that was wet or not wet. Something that a prophet says, this is going to happen. Or if I'm right, this is going to happen. And then it happens. Whoa, look at that.
The recognition that a sign is primarily an evidence of trustworthiness, not of power, sheds light on this verse. So, miracles are about power.
Oh.
Signs are about trustworthiness.
Oh. A miracle, healing somebody, says, I've got power.
Defeating
a sign,
armies is not a miracle then? It's trustworthy, like you're keeping your trust that you're on their side or something? Is that what that would be?
sign like fire from heaven or like frogs.
So here's what the commentary
like
continues.
That. Those are
big. So when the Pharisees demand a sign, it indicates that the demand for a sign is not a request for a miracle. Jesus' miracles are never designed as signs in Mark's gospel, nor were they considered to be signs by the Pharisees. They regard Jesus' miracles as ambiguous actions whose meaning must be confirmed by a sign.
Whoa.
They had witnessed his mighty works, but had concluded they were of demonic agency. Referring back to chapter 3. That is why
so
the Pharisees...
they're not denying the miracles. They're saying...
Oh, they perfectly acknowledge that Jesus is able to perform miracles. As Jesus is not... Performing miracles was not an unusual thing in his time. There were reports of people performing miracles all over the place. So it's a matter of whose power...
Where are you getting it? Give us a sign to show us where you're getting it.
See, when we read the Bible, we think that Jesus is unique in performing miracles.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
Because that's not a part of our lives now.
Whether the miracles actually happened or not is beside the point. It's that people believe that these miracles were occurring frequently all over the place.
Yeah.
Like I said, with Caesar taking over Rome, they almost considered that a miracle event because he changed the course of what was going on and kept the people alive.
Yeah.
And then later on, when a natural disaster came and almost destroyed what they were living under because he was leaving, they took that as a sign
that he
needed to stay where he was. So
So like his defeat of the enemy was a miracle, and the natural disaster was a sign that we need to keep this man. He's wrecked.
Pretty much. But they have, and there was a lot more mysticism. And
he's good for us. And if he leaves,
no
there will be
badness. Where any of it's coming from.
Well, because there was even more than that, because, like, things were attributed to different gods, and people had to pay homage to this god or that god. If something happened to them, they could go pay for it to be taken away.
Mm-hmm. Whatever happened that you didn't really understand was which God did it.
So on the one hand, we should not demonize the Pharisees automatically for not accepting Jesus because of the miracles. They saw the miracles, but people see miracles, saw miracles all the time. The question is, where did that power come from? The problem is that the Pharisees, when they saw Jesus' compassion, they should have recognized his fulfillment of the Old Testament and how he cared for the poor, for the oppressed, how he was freeing the people from oppression.
It they wouldn't have looked at his character and saw where the power was coming from.
They were expecting, as were most of the Jews, freedom from oppression meant freedom from Roman political rule.
Right.
But you got to take into consideration that that's right when Herod was getting his little thing started, and a lot of the people that may have been in line with him might have been the people interrogating Christ at the time. And Herod was deeply involved with the Roman government to keep his place. He was placed there by the Roman government, by the Pharisees' own desires.
So Herod the Great was considered a king.
Right.
He had the title of king. The next Herod, which was in power at this time, never held the title of king.
Oh.
He was never given.
He was just a political figure then by that time.
He was tetrarch.
Yeah.
He was. His influence and authority was lower than that of his predecessor.
Right. But he was still dealing.
He was still trying. He wanted to be known as king.
And so he still had people in his court that would be in this. On this quote unquote board or a part of these officials.
A couple chapters earlier, had the story of Herod, you know, asking, who is Jesus?
Right.
You know, and his answer was, well, it was John the Baptist come back from the dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because of his own guilty conscience.
So throughout these chapters, the question at the background is, who is Jesus? Mm-hmm. Herod gave his answer. The people are giving their answers. Here the Pharisees are questioning.
Uh-huh. Asking
with an assumption that, well, you know, we don't know where your miracles are coming from. Mm-hmm. So we need a sign. Mm-hmm. Now, what we see implied about the Pharisees' assumptions about Jesus are found in what Mark writes here, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. We miss in the English quite a bit of the significance there. A sign from heaven signifies a public definitive proof that God is with him. Mm-hmm. In this light, the qualifying phrase, testing him, is important. It refers to the biblical provision for testing if a prophet has been sent by God, referring back to the test of a prophet in Deuteronomy chapters 13 and 16.
There's a blanket right by the window.
So the demand for a sign is the equivalent to the question of the Jerusalem authorities in chapter 11, verse 30. What is the source of your authority? The last time Jesus was tested?
By Satan in the desert?
Yeah. It's the same word.
Uh-huh.
Literally, the Greek says they sought to test or tempt him.
Tempt. Okay.
Tempting is never a good thing.
Uh-huh. So it's not saying they were wrong to test him. They were wrong to check to see if he's right or wrong. They were wrong to tempt him. That makes more sense.
And Old Testament passages speak of Israel tempting God by doubting his previously demonstrated works and demanding new ones.
Uh-huh.
So here the Pharisees are being placed in the position of the their ancestors who had doubted God.
The way we usually hear it presented, the Pharisees were wrong to test Jesus, to question him.
Questioning is not the problem. It's the assumptions behind the questioning that is the problem.
Yeah, well, and
if they aren't sincere.
In recent years, I thought, why are they wrong to not blindly trust? I mean, really. So often, as it's portrayed to us in Christianity, you must blindly trust or else you're sinful and condemned.
Yeah.
See, back then they used to, like, before they'd go to war or go on a sea voyage or do anything important in their household, they would offer something.
Mm-hmm.
They would make offerings, and they would ask for the blessings of their gods to do the chores that they were planning on doing. And it was considered ill of a person or the group of people that were embarking on this to tempt the gods by saying to themselves on this journey that they were taken care of completely by their blessing that they had been given.
Uh-huh.
And to say, oh, we're totally protected by our God now and everything's fine, or even the other end of it, to start to waver halfway through and feel like your acceptance of the offering wasn't enough, and for you to say out loud, well, we're not going to make it, you know, uh-huh. this isn't going to be right, and that would be...
That would be doubting the gods.
Well, it'd be doubting how much you gave or what you uh-huh. did to receive uh-huh. this blessing at the time. And the tempting of the gods was a common phrase on both sides of it. You did or didn't give enough.
Interesting, yeah. Tempting the gods either could mean that... Either could be presumption,
of
assuming
your,
that you don't have to worry about anything yeah. because it's all taken care of, end of question. Or doubting that it's enough. Interesting.
There was also a lot going on, too, where they had to, like, pay attention to gods in other lands when they went there and mm-hmm. weren't allowed to say ill of gods in other lands while they were there. And all sorts of
unless things. You were really sure of yourself. Unless you're really sure that your god's the
actually
biggest.
it was even more of a...
And that your god can reach all that way.
Well, no, it was more of a... you're not supposed to boast so much over your god
yeah.
because it would make your god mad because then he's forced to have to
right.
prove
you're forcing
in that area mind. Where he it'd be like the Steelers going to California and having one Steeler fan in all of California saying that my team's the best, and then that would force the Steelers to have to go there with all of their power to make sure that that one person was shown that everybody there knew that he was cool enough. And so it was disrespectful of your god at that time to do things like that.
Okay.
Because you're forcing your god, who's supposed to be more powerful than you, with your big mouth, to do something that he didn't exactly plan on doing at the time. It's very interesting stuff. It's really...
Yeah.
Kind of funny how we do that sometimes. Go running off into some other country with all their wonderful world and ways that they live and learn, and we're out there beating on some drum, you know, in the middle of nowhere. It's a wonder people get their heads cut off.
You should all be just like us. Because we're great.
And that's, you know, don't tempt the gods.
Yeah.
So Jesus' response to the Pharisees' question, demand, and tempting is to refuse.
Uh-huh.
Refuse their demand.
Uh-huh.
Why does Jesus refuse? What is this? Why wouldn't Jesus just...
Acquiesce.
Give a sign.
Well, because it's the same as playing into the devil's hands, and we'll just save it if you can. You know, you're so big, show us how big you are. And he declined at that time, too.
Yeah. So why doesn't Jesus accommodate their demands? It'd be so easy. Just give a sign.
Because then they'd
he
be asking.
Want it to be that easy?
Yeah.
No, because
that's
then they'd be blackmailing
about.
Him all the time.
Well, you did that, but now he wants them bigger. I need more.
They'd be, you know, they'd start treating him
for
like
the wrong
some
reason. Candy machine.
Some little old Greek or Roman god that they could offer to and tell what to do all the time.
Well, and that's not what it's about.
You know, they just come up with something.
He is trying to create a society in which you do what's right because it's right. You good, be good to your neighbor.
So what does Jesus say?
Because it's the right thing to do. And saying, because I told you, you have to. Because I'm right.
Well, so in Mark, Jesus' response is he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. Now, some of the other Gospels add a further statement that the only sign will be that I will destroy this temple and
rebuild
it in 3 days or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Speaking of his crucifixion and resurrection.
Right.
But Mark omits that.
He just says no. Nothing.
He says, as far as Mark is concerned, no sign will be given in response to their demands.
Mm-hmm. And then other Gospels write in the little clip note of there will be a sign.
Yeah.
And they do that, why? Because they're telling a different story.
They're telling a different story. They have a different purpose.
Yeah.
Mark is quite black and white when it comes to faith.
Right.
So here's a couple commentaries, their notes. Jesus' refusal of a sign has important historical and theological significance. Historically, the demand for a sign expressed the desire to judge Jesus according to norms defined by scribal interpretation. Mm-hmm. He had already pronounced the scribal norms decayed and sterile, chapters 7, and he now rejects their pretentiousness categorically. Mm-hmm. Theologically, the demand for unmistakable proof that God is at work in Jesus' ministry is an expression of unbelief. It represents the attempt to understand the person of Jesus within categories which were wholly inadequate to contain his reality.
That makes sense.
The scribes and Pharisees had a box that they wanted to fit Jesus into. Just like we today have boxes in which we want to fit interpretations of God. And so we demand signs, just as they did. And Jesus says, no, God says, no, I don't fit into these categories that you create.
Good point. Yeah.
If I were to accommodate your demands, then all I would be doing is reinforcing those boxes that you already have. Now, that doesn't mean that God won't take his own initiative and fit himself into those boxes that we have.
Sometimes,
but he is not going to respond to our demands that he fit into our boxes. There's a difference.
Sometimes when he says, okay, you need a classic definition is what you need at this moment. Okay, I'll give it to you. Because you can understand it. But when they said, define yourself according to our definition, which category are you in?
See, the Old Testament is a history, a story of God fitting himself into boxes that people had. The problem is, by the time the Pharisees, when Jesus comes around, the Pharisees and the scribes, Pharisees, etc., etc., think that the Old Testament defines that box. That's the only thing that God can fit into. Must fit into.
The only way God can.
This is,
And Jesus is saying, no, that's the box that I chose to fit myself into because that's the only way you would understand at that time.
He chose it, not them.
And we do the same thing now with the Old and New Testaments.
Well, we've talked about this for a long time, and what it really boils down to is that God is trying to build a relationship with people, and always has been. And every time he tries to build a relationship with people, it has to be within the bounds of the people because they're always trying to hold God at an arm's length because they want it to be the way they've wanted it. We want a king. Give us a king. We can't have this this randomness or whatever it is, mm-hmm. but this is the New Testament. What Mark is writing is he's trying to depict the era that God has decided not to work within the confines of these rules that have been established over and over again because they're not working to build a relationship with God. They haven't been working. And so this is a reaffirmation of God changing that rule then is what it is, right? I mean, in a sense. Because they wouldn't talk to God unless Moses came and talked to him for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or...
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things that were always... There was always a middleman in between God and the people. There always had to be a point of reference that was man-made before it could go this way.
Yeah.
And now Christ is saying, nope, you got me right here.
Yeah, so I think they had their traditions, which they believed described God and how humankind could relate to God. And Jesus is saying traditions themselves aren't necessarily bad,
mm-hmm.
but it's when a person begins to rely on these traditions as the and begins to enforce them as the only way.
Right.
Demand that someone else define themselves according to your definitions.
Well, of the traditions, yes. I mean, it was so much so to the point in the world that Christ was coming into that if you wanted something to happen with your God, it had to be done distinctly in this fashion and this fashion only, to the point where if you messed up at one point during that time, your whole chance of reaching your God was not going to happen.
Sounds like today's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. Here's
Christianity has a description of God and a definition of God and a way in which you reach God. And if you don't follow that, then you're lost. Period. Mm-hmm. No questions asked.
Yeah.
And in this story, Jesus is saying, cut it out with the enforced definitions.
Yeah. You know, traditions are like tools.
Mm-hmm.
They're useful in appropriate situations. But we don't use a hammer to try to screw in a screw. And, you know, you can use a screwdriver to hammer in a nail, but it's not nearly as efficient as a hammer.
And telling someone else that, for instance, that they must do their job using your tools.
That's more what I was thinking,
mm-hmm.
was if everybody knows you got to use this tool, but whether or not you can get to this tool because you have to go through these people first to get to it was more of what the traditions were starting to build that roadblock between God and his person, you, was being developed through those traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So there were very faithful people that believed in God's period,
mm-hmm.
whatever they were, but there was always a staircase or a ladder or something that involved that very faithful person to be able to be in contact with their God.
Yeah.
And so poor people, in a sense, in that society at that time, may not have had the traditions were set up so that they didn't have a chance to speak to their God as readily as people that were affluent enough to be able to afford the rituals that would gain them the access high enough to repent against certain things that they did or didn't do.
And I think here is one of the maybe the biggest reason why Jesus would not accede to their demand. If Jesus were to accede to their demand, he would be implicitly acknowledging their right as the religious establishment to define and categorize him according to their standards of legitimation.
So right there, they'd be able to set up whatever ladder they wanted to the people to be able to access Christ at that time. Which is seeing some of the things, like when you're reading or when you're watching some of those videos, the information, documentary videos, hearing what some of the generals and the leaders of that time would go through in order to get acceptance to be able to do the things that they were going to do in society makes you realize that for a modern, for us now, it would be like, well, even the if you wanted to take it to somebody in our exact class and situation where we live now, if you were going to start a new business in that society at that time and you wanted the blessing of your God to do so, you'd have to invite half the town to your house, have a huge banquet offered to these gods, and you'd have to make sure that every person in the room was happy before you got the blessing of your God in order to be able to go in, you know, into this next step in your life. And so you think about that, and so all of these things are going to be built upon you every time you want to ask your God for acceptance. Imagine how you would feel if you were some poor wretch in the gutter and you just wanted to plead to God for help. You didn't have the right to.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I'm gonna end real quickly here, but we got through another third, or so. Maybe a quarter.
Interesting.
The Pharisees throughout are presented as pretty evil and nasty, but is that a fair picture? Are they evil?
They're just... Yes, they are. In the sense that they're trying to defend their own... They're trying to defend what they have. Mm-hmm. Because they're fairly powerful people at that time in that society. And they're defending their place at the table of God.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically their plate is full and you have to convince them to get any of it. So yeah, in a sense, they are evil to the population of people that need and deserve a God that wants to be there for them.
The consequence of their actions is evil because it cuts people off from God. But
so like are all Pharisees evil, or is it just Mark's particular characterizations of...
It would be like saying that all Christians and all Muslims are evil at this time.
True.
Because of the polarization between the two groups, it makes it, anybody that generalizes when they say something like that is completely wrong.
Yeah.
But the fundamental hardline people in those factions, yes, are dramatically decreasing the value of those opinions.
They get more attention because they're doing this.
So at this time, because I didn't know that Pharisees, Sadducees, and all these other groups were actually groups of Jewish people that...
Yeah, there were different parts of Jewish thought that were saying we are the faithful ones.
Right. So
the right ones.
And so it's... You can't quite be completely mad at them as a group because they have their hierarchy that would be leading them into this direction. It's not just a... It's not like it's the only the powerful people of this one... You're taking... It'd be like saying that the board of Petersburg is ruining Petersburg. Or is all of Petersburg ruined because these guys are making these choices. It's a small group within that church that's making these decisions to keep their power. So you can't say that they're all bad. I didn't know that, though, less than a month ago at that time. If you were to ask me that question before, mm-hmm. I would have thought differently because I'm thinking that this is a small group of people in power of a large group of people.
Well, Pharisees were very popular. They weren't exactly the biggest group, but they were very popular.
And they were diverse, though. They're not necessarily a group of just straight, only affluent people that lived high on the hog, and they were the people that ran the town. They were a group of, like, a church-going group.
Yeah, the Sadducees were actually the more elite. They were the wealthy. The Pharisees were more of the commoners.
Right.
And then you have the Essenes, who were kind of the, you know, the hermits.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So in a sense, it's doctrine groups of the same religion. Well, kind of like what we have today of Christianity.
Yeah, they all accepted their scriptures as authoritative.
Right.
But it's kind of like the Baptists and the Presbyterians.
It was a battle of interpretation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the Baptists and Presbyterians and Lutherans. And
I mean, so any of these people would be wanting to protect their doctrine at that time. Mm-hmm. They're wanting to take...
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
They can't necessarily be considered Satanistic or evil. But
their intentions, none of their intentions were evil.
No.
You know, all of them thought they had the best interests of Jews in mind, as a whole.
Right.
Just like each Christian denomination thinks, you know, we have...
The truth.
We have the best interpretation of the Bible, that our version of Christianity offers the best hope for Christianity's future.
Right.
But beliefs and actions have consequences, and what Jesus is pointing out, and of course, you know, when the Gospels are being written, there is this distinct conflict between the Christian sect and the sect of what Pharisees are going to turn into.
Right.
Now, the Sadducees do not survive the destruction of the temple, because Sadducees are very dependent on the existence of the temple and the cults and the rituals surrounding it.
So there were no more Sadducees.
Sadducees,
by the time this was written,
They probably are still here. They still exist, but it's the Pharisees that turn into the basically kind of the Jews,
the main Jewish form at that time.
Yeah. That survive into the first and second centuries and have transmitted all these. Because what the Jews have today as their written commentaries, the Midrash and the Mishnah and all of those things, they did not exist at the time of Jesus. They were all oral traditions.
I see. Mm-hmm.
That were written down in the second and third centuries and further on.
And they were oral traditions because the only way that you were learned in those traditions was by birth and by
years
of learning with that person.
Part of Jewish thought is there is no singular interpretation of Scripture.
I see.
If you write something down, it becomes fixed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually susceptible to interpretation once you write it down.
Right.
That's what I read
can no longer be part of the culture of the people. It can no longer evolve
prior to written text, ancient civilizations believed it actually dumber to have to write your stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
Because the interpretation, the actual, not interpretation, but the actual gist of the information would get lost to people later on trying to read it. They may not even be smart enough to read it to understand,
like we feel now,
what has been written down. So it was more important to keep a lineage of people passing this verbal direct information to somebody that thought and understood it exactly the way that you did, so that it never changed as it was going through the generations. It was very important to keep that information that way.
For Jews, their interpretation of what is holy wasn't supposed to be fixed. It was supposed to evolve and change to meet the needs of each generation.
So it was upon it was levied upon the people that were passing it to pass it so that it made sense to the next group of people.
The next generation.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that's part of what I was just getting at, was to make sure that the ideology was passed so that they understood.
As opposed to just the letter.
Well, think about picking something up in 100 years and trying. Well, obviously, look at your Shakespeare book. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to put another side on it so that anybody that was just nobody picked that book up, they would be able to read it and get some information out of it other than, and get a concept of what was being written, not just a...
As opposed to simply reading the words, but not receiving the meaning.
Right. Having to almost make up your own. Yeah. You'd almost have to make up your own. Like, maybe I think these people are having a an issue, but maybe I don't know because the difference in context is so huge.
Yeah, so... All this is to say that we need to be careful when we talk about what Pharisees or Sadducees, to not portray them, their people, as evil.
Right. You know, well, that's a really good point to make then, because we all too often pick up our torch and immediately demonize a group of individuals for the actions of the few in that group. I mean, we do that a lot.
And I think the audience, Mark's audience, would have understood that. That what Mark is doing is he's attacking the ideologies, the priorities, and the consequences of Pharisaic ideology.
Right, and action. Okay. And at the same time, giving us the tools to see in our actions and our groups and our churches to be flexible enough to understand that we need to see that in ourselves and what we do as groups, as churches, to realize that we need to be wary of ourselves creating these impressions.
What this is showing is it's easy to become cultic
and rigid.
Pharisaic and rigid ourselves.
Yes. Very easy, because you can see how quickly that's what we want as a human. That's our sin, is we want that structure dictated how we see it fit, and we want to fit into that, and that's where we want to stay. And we can't exactly do that, because when we do, we start looking to other humans and saying, well, you're just not doing it the way we say, because we've made it right.
Yeah. And it's okay to critique ideas, but we should not attack another human being.
And see, what that's doing is it's, once again, even in our time, it's radicalizing our ideologies as Christians, because you're basically saying as a Christian that we need to be accepting and understanding of all forms of worship. Whether we think they're right or not, we need to before we go in to talk to somebody about religion, we have to absolutely respect what somebody else may believe before we can even give our opinion on how we feel about God at that time.
Otherwise, we're trying to put God in a box of our own creation.
Well, we're fitting him into our opinion.
And demanding that the people around us also get their God out of that same box. Their meaning in life needs to come from the same box.
So what is that? Where does that put people in an evangelistic category then? What are you supposed to do when you want to?
Well,
so you're walking a really fine line as far as somebody who wants to go spread that good news. I mean, an extremely fine line.
Had to change the whole culture of the people you went to match your own, because that's what Christianity looks like anymore. Not only do you not need to change the culture necessarily, but maybe you can learn from what the people already have that you're going to.
But that's
and maybe help them define God.
But that's where you get into the not sociopathic, but the the bipolarism of the Bible, or not, there's the other word for it, but you get into this whole thing where, like, okay, well, you're supposed to accept everybody, but then you have to abide by this here, and these, you know, I mean, because are you really supposed to just go accept everybody's God and not care? It's really hard to define as somebody who wants to, I mean, because you've just learned this really cool thing. You're excited about God. You've become a different, quote-unquote, to yourself, better person because you've heard this word and now you think you understand it.
So
but you also have to, you're also kind of bound by it a little bit to be loyal to it. And your loyalty to it means that you can't really go around accepting everybody's God now because that wouldn't be acceptable. But what Mark is kind of saying is that you do have to actually accept other people's God.
So can you impart what you've discovered to someone else who is not like yourself?
You have to do it, yes, without accepting their God and accepting their God at the same time.
Yeah.
You have to do it where you say to that person, I've learned, I mean, this is what I'm getting. I'm not saying it has to be that way. This is kind of what I'm understanding is that it's important to share your knowledge of the God that you understand in a way that it's literally just sharing the knowledge of a God that you understand the way you understand it. Without any imposition, without any...
Well,
need for that person to claim your God the way that you see. Is that what is that what you're getting at?
You can share what God has done in your own life without the expectation that someone else has to experience that same thing. But just how you yourself have been affected by it.
Well, yeah, it's hard. What we see later on in, you know, in Christian history after Jesus is that the apostles go into synagogues, especially Paul, because Christianity is not a separate religion. It's part of Judaism.
Right.
And you notice that whenever trouble brews, it's usually at the instigation of Jews. Jews who are against the Christian sect.
Right.
You know, it's not, it's typically not, the originators of trouble are usually not the pagans, the Greeks and Romans.
Right.
The Jews often incite them, the Greeks and Romans, against the Christians.
So Mark is more or less appealing not necessarily to an audience of Christians of today's ideology of a Christian, but he's trying to appeal to the audience of Jewish people that aren't yet Christians.
That's part of it. I think Mark, though, is written... Well, the Gospel of Mark is written to Roman Christians.
Yeah.
Who do live in a pagan environment. You know, a non-Jewish environment.
Right. So he's later on. What's happening is it's the Jewish religion is still, it's basically just still a power struggle between the new theistic world and the old one that existed before it, because at that time the rest of the world still believed in a pantheon.
For the first century, the battle is within Judaism. Until eventually they part ways. Judaism and Christianity separate.
So it's pretty. It's pretty striking then that modern Christians and modern Christianity still has no interest in that part of the story then. That...
What has happened, I think, is that, you know, for some reason, within Christianity, we've grown up assuming that, you know, somehow Christianity suddenly appeared.
Right.
As a separate religion.
Exactly, because until I watched the little bit of that documentary on Paul that I did not really know, and until we actually got to this point, that Judaism and Christianity are actually the same religion and should have, if things went the way they were supposed to,
it should
been together and actually stayed one religion.
Yeah, that was Paul's dream. That was Paul's hope. That all Jews would come to accept Christ.
Right.
Judaism could simply evolve as it was meant to do.
Because that is their God.
Yeah. It's the same God.
Right. A monotheistic, one God environment that is to be brought to the people and have a relationship with those people. Mm-hmm. See, that part is lost on almost, and that's something that I can say because I wasn't raised fundamentally in a church per se. Mm-hmm. So as kind of a outsider in a way, that story is not told to outsiders. That story is not even remotely given in the standard arena of religion right now. Neither one of them talk about it. Neither side talks about the idea that this is... So is that a problem?
That was one of the options for Judaism to...
Is that a reason why... When we talk about the church that Christ was trying to create at the time never really happening, is that kind of a reason why? Is that the split stayed so that it's almost impossible to get the cohesion of a church that Paul talks about together?
I think the problem is humans.
Okay. Well, it's terrible to say that, because if you talk about that split being the problem, then you're again inciting an anti-Semitic ideology, and that this needs to be...
No, the problem is humans.
Oh, yeah. No.
There are 40,000 Christian denominations today.
Today.
Why? Because one group thinks we're right, and others thinks we're right.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, we can't agree to disagree.
Right. Well, that's pretty interesting information to hear, that at that time, a split was the last thing people were hoping for. At least the apostles and Christ and the Christian community at that time was not looking for a separate religion.
No one was advocating for a separate religion. It happened because there was no other way.
Right.
It's close, huh?
So what does that say for us now, though?
I mean, not that we care, because
we have followed in the traditions. We have followed in the splitting traditions.
Because we're right back there again, where the reason why there's 40,000 denominations is that it's just continually splitting and branching off into different ideas. So what's that leave people with that understand it this way? Leaves you with a choice to split again. Pretty much presents that impossibility that you either split or you're happy to adhere to any Christian culture that you may encounter.
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, in order for you to define yourself as a Christian, to say that you follow Christ, you're put in that same position as to, well, how do you?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to define it, or you have to say it, or you have to be part of something in order to...
Yeah, I think that's kind of what Jesus was speaking out against, is this enforcement of a box.
Yeah, and in order for you to go into the world and have these conversations with, or commune with people... And accept, have people accept you, more or less, because you're going to want to accept people because you're accepting and you want to just leave that part of it out. But in order to have any clout, I mean, even presidents nowadays, they have to say, well, what church do they go to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're a Christian, but what Christian are you? You know, and if
define
you...
Define yourself. Right,
yeah, are you a real Christian, or are you kind of a semi-Christian?
Exactly. Are you one of these non-denominational, or
are
what?
Are you a not properly defined Christian?
You gotta watch out for those non-denominational.
And so it puts you in a position... You know, 3,000 years later, in that same, you're stuck in that same spot. Mm-hmm. With that knowledge that Christ was saying, no, I can't be defined, stop trying, well, you don't have that.
Yeah, then you don't have to define everybody according to your...
So now you got no church, though, because nobody's going to come because they're like, well, where's the church? Matt, we don't know today. Well, how powerful is your church? Not really. I don't know. How many members do you have? I can't tell because I don't know who actually wants to come and doesn't want to come.
Well, but does church need to be powerful and populous?
No, I doubt that very highly, but at the same time, people want...
But it's expected.
And have.
It's expected that church should be a powerful,
growing, large...
Yes, a force in society. And even if the individual members of the church contribute to society and become a force in society just through their lives... It's harder to see if the church as a whole is not a force in society. Being out there wearing church shirts or uniforms or something and doing church work.
Yeah.
Labeled as such. Like the Salvation Army and Mormon people. They have name tags and uniforms, and when they do church work, you can see that it's church work. Mm-hmm. They're not just being...
I don't do this sarcastic. I don't say these things sarcastically. I say them because, to me, it's always been up to us as humans to show God, to show our relationship with God through what we do. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily who we do it with or how we do it.
So
it's never been important to me to say to somebody else, I believe in God, and this is why I'm doing this, is because I believe in Him, and I hope you know that.
Right.
That's never dawned on me, and I don't care. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it doesn't leave it doesn't leave people that want to be defined by something anywhere to define it.
Right.
They have nowhere to define it.
And that's difficult. But... To me, it's more Christ-like to just be without trying to define it or declare it as such, without having to wear the shirt while doing
box.
It.
Without the box.
Yeah.
So, that's where we are. And we will continue on.